targeted. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Our soldiers are still vulnerable, and we must take this threat seriously. With these words, the Pentagon summarized the situation in the areas of deployment of U.S. occupation forces in Syria and Iraq at a time when Washington began carrying out attacks on what it said were missile launch sites at its bases. It is apparent through the acceleration of the attacks and the expansion of their targeting that the resistance forces have begun a new phase of their operations aimed at increasing the level of risk for the Americans in the event they decide to stay in Syria after they decided to resume their military and political activity there. It is true that this path is not new, but recent developments indicate that there is vigorous effort being directed against the Americans, which during the past year amounted to more than 10 in Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor, while it seems that it will exceed this number in less than a month this year, if it actually continues at this new pace. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is retired Syrian Army General and political analyst Mr. Mohammed Abbas. Well, Mr. Mohammed, thank you for being with us now. Coinciding with the second anniversary of the assassination of the dual leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Deputy of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we have what is now known as the Popular Resistance renewing its targeting of U.S. occupation bases in Syria, forcing the Americans to withdraw from a 10th phase into Jordan in fear of being targeted. How do you assess such an achievement?
Thank you very much. Actually, when we talk about Soleimani, military Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, we should remember that despite their militarism, they will be able to continue their business in the theater of war. Actually, through the continuation of the popular resistance and the front, confront the occupation targeting America bases, preventing them from any stability in Syria and Iraq, exposing the state of fear experienced by American forces in Syria and Iraq, and forcing them to temporarily maneuver part of their forces towards Jordan, which is an evidence of the American inability to confront the resistance forces. Military American leaders predict that the attacks against their occupied forces are going to be increased much more. That is why America is going to change its troops, instead of the American nationality soldier, change it by the American proxy armies, which consists of ISIS and Al Qaeda and Nusra and other troops, what called the Islamic groups. Indeed, but indeed they are the Arab version of Blackwater, the American security company. That is how USA avoids loses among the there's no soldiers loses from the American nationality, but only you can say the loss of the casualties. More all casualties nowadays are being in the proxy armies, from what called the American proxy armies, actually.
The resistance fighters not only targeted the U.S. occupation bases of Conoco and Al Shadadi on New Year's Eve with several mortar and rocket-propelled grenades, but they did it again by targeting the largest American base in Al Umar oil field in Syria. Do you expect an increase in anti-American operations in Iraq, as is in Syria, or was that latest round only linked maybe to the second anniversary of the martyrdom of the two leaders?
Thank you. Certainly, the memory of the military Soleimani and al-Muhandis is so precious to the Syrian and Iraqi people. But the military operations against the occupation forces are going to be continued against the American occupation in many shapes, in many shapes, not only on by targeting using the rockets or artillery, but there are other types in the targeting in the oil fields, targeting in the military bases, targeting on the side roads, using the using mines, snipers, using many types of the of obstacles against that American forces. But I'd like to tell you something, maybe or this note. That American soldiers who has nationality soldiers, American nationality soldiers, are using helicopters to move from point to other. But the proxy armies, soldiers or warriors, the American proxy warriors used to use the vehicles and land transportation. Why? To avoid the bombsite explosions or other things. By the way, Syrian and Iraqi citizens will not allow the American forces to continue their practices on our land. They are going to go on for in their resistances. But I'd like to say, despite the resistance is still growing, but the American analysts predict a complex, coordinated, and deliberate attacks and sophisticated strikes. Resistance is becoming more accurate, more effective, and a spate of escalation in attacks are happening daily. They are using bomb sites, as I said, and rose mines and other weapons. You can use a stone, you can use a stick, you can use the situation of our Syrian people in many villages and many towns who prevent Americans from using the from passing the during the streets or the village. It is a sign or a sign to see or to say that you are we will not allow America to stay in our land
Well, Mr. Muhammad, it is evident that the resistance factions have pushed the Americans to evacuate Al-Tanf base, as we said at the beginning of the show. But this act actually shows how the Americans are unable to impose any new battlefield equations here. But it gives me a bit of a concern here. There is Syrian concern, general concern that the U.S. might retaliate militarily to attempt to protect its occupation forces in Syria. How do you think that would be possible?
Of course, Syrian people is supporting the. First of all, Syrian people are supporting the public resistance movement, which poses high combat capabilities that emerged through this using artillery, mortars, rocket artillery, and other means, with the ability to make serious strategic and high precision of using drones in injury. The American concern about the increase of in operation is clear, and the base temporary evacuation is the evidence of that. Emphasizing that the Americans are retaliating Syrian forces, they are retaliating Syrian forces actually daily. Daily, not you are waiting them, but they use it daily to retaliate from Syria. By how? By using the employing proxy armies or by itself through the exchanging rules between the American and Turkish and Israeli forces by itself or by the proxy warriors. How we can explain, how you can understand the Israeli targeting or strikes, continuous strikes against Syria and the Turkish occupies the wide areas in southern of Syria. And the what's about the Syrian defense? What is the Syrian defense forces? SDF. It is another type of ISIS. Mm-hmm. What called SDF is another type of ISIS, another type of proxy American armies. So I'd like to remember or to say that Americans troops, American jet bombed Syrian forces in Al-Tarda on 2016, as I think,
by air forces who targeted Syrian Arab Army soldiers. We remember that very well, and we will never forget that, actually. Mr. Muhammad, I want to thank you very much. Sadly, that's all the time that we have, but I promise that we will have you again to talk more about how the Syrian population is refusing to have occupation, any kind of occupation on its land. I want to thank you very much, Syrian Army General, retired Syrian Army General and political analyst, Mr. Mohammed Abbas Mohammed, for joining us. Thank you for your time. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Palestinians are facing Israeli bullets on a daily basis in the West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Palestinian Bakir Hashash, 21 years old, was killed by the Israeli occupation in the occupied West Bank early on Thursday as the occupation entered an area east of the northern city of Nablus to make administrative arrests. Meanwhile, 24 Palestinians were wounded by Israeli bullets during clashes that took place in several areas across the occupied West Bank, trying to condemn the illegal settlements. The center of Hebron has been witnessing almost weekly activities rejecting the occupation and settlement building, which the occupation forces confront by firing live and rubber bullets and tear gas canisters. The occupation forces continue their attacks against the Palestinians after launching a massive campaign of raids in the West Bank, especially in Bethlehem, Halhul, and Jenin. Palestinians face Israeli bullets in the occupied West Bank in this following report.
Israeli occupation forces continue to assault Palestinians in various cities and villages of the occupied West Bank. The Israeli operation saw the occupation launch a large-scale raid campaign in the occupied West Bank, especially in Nablus, Beit Lahem, Halhul, and Jenin, leading to the death of 21-year-old Bakir Hashash and wounding scores others. Palestinian natives responded to the attacks by retaliating with rocks against the illegal colonial settlers, especially near the town of Tekoa, southeast of Bethlehem. Young Palestinian youth also resorted to targeting a settler bus near Halhul, north of Hebron, with Molotov cocktails to pressure Israeli forces out of their towns. Palestinian media also stated that occupation forces deployed heavily in the Bir Ayyub neighborhood, the entrance to Ain al-Lawza and Al-Ain Street in the town of Silwan, adding that the forces set up roadblocks, closed the streets of Bir Ayyub, attacked the neighborhood with multiple grenades, and arrested two young men, Mundir Ruwaidi and Ihab Abu Sneina. As if the Israeli aggression was not enough, the Palestinian Authority security apparatuses took matters into their own hands, arresting the son of prisoner Zakaria al-Zubaydi, Muhammad al-Zubaydi, along with some of his companions. However, due to the intensity of the situation, the Palestinian Authority was pressured to release Muhammad al-Zubaydi at Saturday dawn, just hours after detaining him in Jenin-occupied West Bank. Muhammad al-Zubaydi, Ayham al-Saadi, and Aus al-Shalabi were released following intense calls to simmer down the situation in the Jenin refugee camp. Public resentment is on the rise against the Palestinian National Security Services in the Jenin camp, with the camp's residents opening fire against the district headquarters, infuriated by the continuous Palestinian Authority crackdown on residents of the camp, especially after a video went viral showing the Palestinian National Security Services inhumanely assaulting and arresting Muhammad al-Zubaydi in Jenin. The use of violence, severe beating, and human rights violations when done by the Zionist entity are clear acts of occupation against native Palestinians. However, when done by the Palestinian Authority, are nothing but shameful, reoccurring phenomena in Palestine. Not so long ago, activist Nizar Banat was killed due to the use of violence and severe trauma. The same could have happened to Muhammad al-Zubaydi if the batons had hit the young man in the head. This violence only reflects the security apparatus's incompetence, weakness, divergence from the values of Palestinians, and lack of respect for their dignity. This physical violence will only result in counter-violence and hatred, yet sadly the lack of accountability will simply exacerbate such a crackdown.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Ramallah is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zeit University and political analyst. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Saad. Dr. Saad, 22-year-old Palestinian Bakir Muhammad Musa Hashash was shot in the head after the Israeli occupation forces entered Blata refugee camp east of Nablus city to make administrative arrests late last week. Bakir is not the first nor the last to be martyred at the hands of the Zionist occupation forces, but it seems that fire is raging in the West Bank, this time much different than any other time before. Why do you think that?
Well, it's quite sure for us that the Israeli had ended the last year by killing Hashash, but not that to stop anyway. By the beginning of this year also, the escalation is so high in the Israeli troops against the occupation troops and the settlers against the Palestinians. It's quite clear that there is a kind of an escalation in the last year and all over last year, 2021. Till today, it's quite obvious that the settlers are trying to gain time as much as they could, since the American administration are not interested so far in the Middle East issue, and they are focusing more on the Iranian issue, on Russia and on China, rather than the Middle East. And I think that the Israeli and the settlers particularly, and especially the government, because this government, the Israeli government, is a settler government, are trying to gain the time and try to make facts on the ground that would be very hard to reverse. Because of that, they are trying to grab as much land as they could. They are trying to escalate the confiscation of land, building settlements, and enlarging existing settlements. All that was in a kind of a campaign against the Palestinians in the last year.
Well, sadly, the Palestinian National Security Services are not giving the West Bank any slack either. I mean, the continuous crackdown against Palestinian activists is on the rise, like we just saw last week with Mohammed al-Zubaydi, son of one of the Freedom Tunnel heroes, Zakaria al-Zubaydi, being beaten up and arrested like he was a thug, with video documenting this horrific assault. Although he was released later on Saturday because of all the continuous pressure, it's still physical violence that will only result in counter-violence. Why is the Palestinian Authority adamant on going down the road of violence against its own people?
Yeah, we are getting now into totally another area here, let me say, where when we talk about the Palestinian resistance, we mean that all kinds of resistance for the Palestinian people should be allowed, and Palestinians have the right to resist the occupation in any way they find it appropriate. That was according to the 1982 resolution in the United Nations. Mm-hmm. Now, the Palestinian Authority, and particularly President Mahmoud Abbas, he believed from the very beginning in a non-violence line of resistance. Because of that, the orders for the security forces, in Palestinian security forces, is to stop any kind of violence and to maintain only popular, as they call it, peaceful resistance to the occupation, and at the same time they are continuing with the cooperation with the Israelis, and especially in the security coordination, which also came as a hard grab against the Palestinian resistors who are trying, you know, to do sometimes some operations. We believe, as Palestinians, that most of the Palestinians believe that the Israeli occupation is an act of violence, as I would put it, as exactly Franz Fanon had put it. Any occupation is an act of violence, and we need to react in also in a violence way. That's the only way to resist this occupation. Yes, I believe in the popular resistance and the both intifadas, the first one and the second one. It started as a popular resistance by the Palestinian people, but at the same time, we do need all kind of other sorts of resistance to exist, and the Palestinian Authority is committing a huge mistake by preventing Palestinians from practicing their own resistance. Now, that would come to an end, which might be, you know, very bad, especially that the Israeli occupation and settlers are continuing on a daily basis in you know, attacking the Palestinians and grabbing the land. And what is the answer by the Palestinian Authority? It's just, you know, trying to calm down the situation and try to say, yeah, we will resist by the popular resistance. This is not enough, and we believe that sooner or later, and what happened yesterday or the few days ago, Friday, on Jenin, as the incident that you mentioned, that the Palestinian resistors, they started even shooting at the Al-Muqata'a, at the headquarters, the Palestinian headquarters of the security forces in Jenin, and today everyone was commenting on that, is showing that if the Palestinian Authority is continuing with this kind of line in not attacking the Israeli troops and allowing the settlers in doing so without any kind of resistance, definitely the Palestinians are going to go further mm-hmm. in their resistance.
Definitely. When they see that there is no real resistance yes. on the ground, they will make their own way to resist. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zeid University and political analyst, for joining us to talk about the latest very risky situation in the West Bank, with all hopes and support for the Palestinian people, for academics like you, and for the youth like those who are resisting this Zionist aggression. I want to thank you very much. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. Please stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream. Salam.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Today we're going to be asking a question about a very fundamental question which often comes in the mind of non-Muslims. Sometimes it also comes in the minds of Muslims, but obviously this question, it wouldn't have come to the mind of Muslims if it wasn't raised by non-Muslims. And that question is Islam a violent religion or not? Now, in order to, and then if it is a violent religion, then how is this justifiable? Well, we can approach this question in a polemic way, and then approach it in an intellectual and a rational way. And when we approach it in a polemic way, we have to see this: is Islam really more violent than other religions or not? It's interesting to note that a software engineer, he analyzed the Quran and the Bible. He analyzed them, and to see which one was more violent, and he found that, it's interesting to note that in his processing of these two holy books, to see which one is the most violent. In his conclusion, he wrote this. This person, his name was Tom Anderson. He was a software engineer. He said that this project was inspired by the ongoing public debate around whether or not terrorism connected with Islamic fundamentalism reflects something inherently and distinctly violent about Islam compared to other major religions or not. It just took about 2 minutes for his software to analyze these two books. But he found that, surprisingly, the Old Testament was far more violent than the New Testament. and more than twice as violent as the Quran. Mr. Anderson summarized his conclusion in the following way. He said that killing and destruction are referenced slightly more often in the New Testament, 2.8%, than in the Quran, 2.1%. But the Old Testament clearly leads more than twice that of the Quran in mentions of destruction and killing, 5.3%. He adds, first I want to make it very clear that we have not set out to prove or disprove that Islam is more violent than other religions. Moreover, we realized that the Old and New Testaments and the Quran are neither the only literature in Islam and Christianity and Judaism, nor do they constitute the sum of these religions, religious teachings, and protocols. Nevertheless, this is a conclusion that he reached, which is interesting. So polemically, we could say that these texts, which form very fundamental and essential sources of doctrine in these religions, right? We see that polemically, we could say that these two texts, which are the sources of Judeo-Christian faith, statistically, we can say that there are references to violent concepts within the sacred scriptures, such as death, killing, destruction, the destruction of nations, and so on and so forth. But if we were to use this as a measure of a book which is violent and of violence and not, we would have to say that no, the other Abrahamic scriptures are more violent than the Quran. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at violence and the Quran and Islam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing renewed anger from MPs and bereaved families on Monday, 24th of January, after the disclosure that his fiancée threw him a surprise lockdown birthday party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Jessica Elgott and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson Faces Fresh Outrage Over Lockdown Birthday Party. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing renewed anger from MPs and bereaved families on Monday after a disclosure that his fiancée threw him a surprise lockdown birthday party, as sources said an official inquiry had uncovered appalling evidence of mismanagement at the heart of Downing Street. Sue Gray, a senior civil servant leading the inquiry into Downing Street parties, is expected to make deeply critical recommendations on overhauling Number 10's operation after hearing of repeated failures of leadership, according to a White House source who spoke to the inquiry. In the latest alleged breach of rules, Number 10 Downing Street admitted that Carrie Johnson held a party for the Prime Minister and up to 30 staff on 19th of June 2020, despite COVID rules banning indoor social gatherings of all kinds. Outdoor gatherings were limited to groups of 6 individuals. ITV reported that the Prime Minister attended the party in the Cabinet Room at Number 10 at 2 p.m. on his 56th birthday, and that the interior designer Lulu Little, who was not a member of Number 10 staff, was also there. The room was said to have been laid out with Marks and Spencer party food and a birthday cake, with staff singing happy birthday and staying for 20 to 30 minutes. Number 10 Downing Street said the Prime Minister attended for 10 minutes and denied reports from ITV that he held a party later on, 19th of June, in his Downing Street residence. Sue Gray is understood to have already been told about the allegations, meaning the latest expose is unlikely to delay publication of her report, expected later on this week. Spokesperson for interior designer Lulu Little said she was working on the controversial refurbishment of Boris Johnson's flat on that day, adding, Lulu was not invited to any birthday celebrations for the Prime Minister as a guest. Lulu entered the cabinet room briefly as requested while waiting to speak with the Prime Minister. It comes as whips have been warned that Boris Johnson is facing the possibility of losing a vote of no confidence amid growing anger about the multiplying revelations. One senior MP estimated up to a third of the ministerial payroll, ranging from ministers to principal private secretaries and Tory vice chairs, could vote against the Prime Minister, leaving Boris Johnson reliant on support from at least half of his backbench MPs. On Monday night, 24th of January, angry MPs said they were fuming at the latest drip-drip of lockdown breach stories. And presumably, there is more being stored up for release after the Sue Gray report, just in case that hadn't dealt the killer blow, one said. Another Conservative MP who has not yet submitted a no-confidence letter said, the birthday gathering was clearly social and changes things a lot. The Guardian understands that the Labour Party is poised to attempt to force the publication of the full Sue Gray report at its Opposition Day debate next week, should No. 10 Downing Street attempt to hold back the full details and only publish summary findings. A front bencher said those who had been running the numbers of would-be rebels for the Prime Minister over the weekend were becoming increasingly concerned that Boris Johnson could lose a no-confidence vote, despite multiple charm offensive calls to wavering MPs. People have been telling them over the weekend that they are behind the Prime Minister, but of course that could be people lying, the source said. Ultimately, there's a third of the payroll I could see voting against the Prime Minister. If that happens, he needs at least half of all backbenchers to back him. That seems pretty unlikely. You can see things get dangerous quickly. Most MPs are still determined to wait for the outcome of Sue Gray's inquiry, expected later on this week. Johnson is alleged to have also hosted family and friends later that afternoon in his home, but No. 10 Downing Street denied this, claiming he hosted a small number of relatives outside only. Regarding the 2 p.m. gathering, a No. 10 spokesperson said a group of staff working in No. 10 on that day gathered briefly in the cabinet room after a meeting to wish the Prime Minister a happy birthday. He was there for less than 10 minutes. Addressing the later alleged party in the flat, a spokesperson said, this is totally untrue. In line with the rules at the time, the Prime Minister hosted a small number of family members outside that evening. On Monday, 24th of January, Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's former chief advisor, said he had handed written evidence to the Gray inquiry, but warned that some staff were concerned about handing over evidence fearing retribution from the Prime Minister. Senior civil servant Sue Gray has reassured some staff there would be given a degree of protection. However, one source who has given evidence to the inquiry said fears of retribution persisted. Junior staff have been concerned if they are seen to corroborate what's in the press, one Whitehall source said. People have been burnt as well by the Priti Patel investigation, where the advice was suppressed and the conclusion wasn't followed. It's one thing to be asked and not lie, and quite another to offer the evidence proactively. The Labour Party, meanwhile, demanded in a letter to Boris Johnson that he stand by his assurance in Parliament on 8th of December to place a copy of the report, then being compiled by Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, in the Commons Library for all MPs to see. Labour Party's Deputy Leader Angela Rayner said the government cannot allow any further cover-up and urged Boris Johnson to give MPs an embargoed copy of the report to let them read the detail before quizzing him in Parliament. Tory MPs said there would be outrage among backbenchers should there be any attempt to censor the findings of the report. Another said the only reason you would hold it back is because you've calculated that whatever's in there is worth taking the flak for trying to hide it. A third person said the more that's withheld, the less likely it is to be accepted. The Labour Party could also table a humble address motion to force the government to publish the report in full or parts of the evidence to ensure any testimony of criminality has been passed to the police. However, if the government pulls Labour's next Opposition Day debate, other options being considered are using a select committee to request documents. Scotland Yard reiterated its previous statement, saying if Sue Gray's inquiry finds evidence of a potential criminal offence, then police officers will make a further consideration on whether to investigate. Reacting to the birthday party revelations on Monday, Joe Goodman, co-founder of COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice, said, "Like thousands of others, I remember 19th of June vividly. It was the day before what could have been my dad's 73rd birthday, shortly after he had passed away from COVID-19. It's completely sickening that the Prime Minister spent time sharing cake with 30 friends indoors. Every day and every fresh scandal pours salt on the wounds of the hundreds of thousands who have lost their loved ones. If he had any decency, he would do what we and the rest of the country is calling for him to do and go."
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, let's talk about the food and trading in food, you know. Lots of people, in fact, find it too hard to find a job. And when it comes to it, sometimes you are forced actually to find any spot in the supermarket or sales business. So is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to work in the areas of food in non-Muslim countries and trade in these foods? And we know for sure that lots of these foods are not ritually pure, so they are haram. Is it permissible to trade in haram food?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when it comes to pork, Ayatollah Sistani says that it is not permissible to sell pork as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
Now here Ayatollah Sistani actually maintains precaution.
Right.
And precaution means that this is not a fatwa. He simply exercises precaution and wants his followers to exercise precaution as well, you know, not by not selling pork.
Right.
Pork is ritually impure. Okay. But as a Muslim, if you want to work for example in a sales department,
right,
sales department, you can carry pork from one place to another place. You can work in a slaughterhouse, and it does not mean that you're selling it.
Mm-hmm.
You as someone working, doing the cleaning job, and
yes,
and carrying pork from one place to another place, and there's no objection to you. But when it comes to delivering a pork, you cannot deliver pork to the clients. If you know that the package contains pork, it is not permissible as an obligatory precaution to deliver pork to the customers. But if you do not know whether the food package contains pork or not, it's not necessary for you to investigate. You can still deliver it. Even though there is possibility, a slight possibility that the food package might contain pork.
Yes.
Okay.
If there's a possibility, then...
Then you can go ahead. You can sell it because you're not sure, okay?
Mm.
The food, there could be halal meat, there could be, you see, rice, there could be anything halal, but, you know, there's also a possibility, there's a chance that the food might contain something haram.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an objection.
But what about working in a slaughterhouse where there are pigs?
Of course.
The pigs are slaughtered, and you know that the pigs are slaughtered.
You know, you can work as a cook, cooking pork.
Yes.
Ayatollah Sistani says that there's no problem. You can cook non-halal meat, including pork.
But then you're going to, you're going to make sure that this is going to be delivered later to the customers.
Oh, you're not going to deliver it. You have nothing to do with the delivery, you know.
But you have been engaged in killing them.
Yeah, you're working in the butcher's, in the slaughterhouse.
Yes.
There's no objection to you working there.
Mm-hmm.
There's also no objection to you working as a cook.
Right.
Preparing the food for non-Muslims. But you are not directly involved in selling the food and receiving the cash from non-Muslims. As long as you are not directly involved, you are still allowed to work there.
Right.
To work there. Generally speaking, it is permissible to work in a convenience store or in a superstore or in a store. Okay.
Yes.
Even if you know that your job involves carrying pork, you know, putting non-halal meat on the shelf and on the counter or whatever, and these are you know, and when it comes to chicken, of course, when
right.
it comes to chicken, mm-hmm. to beef, to mutton, you know,
mm-hmm.
these are the different types of meat.
Yes,
Ayatollah Sistani says there is no problem in selling these to non-Muslims who do not care about halal and haram things, you know. It's permissible to sell...
Because you're not selling them to Muslims, basically.
Yeah, you're not
right?
selling. You cannot sell these things to Muslims.
Yes, only to the non-believers.
To non-Muslims, of course.
Yeah.
You know, non-Muslims, they always eat such things, haram meat, of course. And so it is always permissible to sell beef, mutton, and, you know, chicken,
okay.
Even though they are haram to non-Muslims.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker. We were talking about whether it is permissible, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani, to work and trade in the food in the non-Muslim countries. So, Sheikh Javid, you said that, as long as you are not engaged in the delivery of, for example, some special food like
pork,
for example,
yes.
All right?
Yeah.
Which is najis or ritually impure. And to the non-Muslims, it is permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani.
Yes.
But you cannot deliver them, in fact, obviously, to the Muslims.
Yes. I would like to add, I need to further explain the issue.
All right.
You know, because you said that Muslims are working, Muslims in the West can't find jobs,
mm-hmm.
and they have to end up working in such places.
Exactly.
Sometimes they might want to sell alcohol, and alcohol is everywhere.
Yes.
what would be the
Jurisprudential status?
Yeah, status. Now, alcohol is absolutely forbidden according to all religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani, and all every other religious authority.
All right.
But in case every Muslim individual working in such places should try his best to avoid selling alcohol, okay, and doing any task, any job associated with alcohol is forbidden, like for example washing alcohol bottles in a restaurant,
yes,
or glasses used for drinking wine or alcohol is absolutely forbidden, washing them,
yes,
and also carrying such bottles to clients, to people, mm-hmm, here and there is absolutely forbidden. Delivering alcohol to non-Muslims or to anyone is absolutely forbidden. Now, there are some rare cases of Muslims who cannot find jobs, and if they leave their jobs, they will definitely, their families will suffer,
mm-hmm,
and they themselves will find it very difficult,
yes,
to maintain their families.
Yes, there will be financial consequences,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah. So their constraints are there. Now, in such cases, if a person is supposed to deal with alcohol, of course, Ayatollah Sistani says that he can take the money with the intention of istinqaz.
Uh-huh.
Istinqaz.
What is that?
Istinqaz means that a person has to have this intention to secure the money, and take the money with the intention of securing it,
mm-hmm,
so that he may use the money for halal purpose.
All right.
Okay? And this is what istinqaz is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Istinqaz means to save the money, to secure it, so that you may use the money for a halal purpose.
Right.
Okay? And and if you have this intention, there is no problem in receiving that money, you know? Istinqaz is meaningful and relevant when you want to deal with a non-Muslim.
And you don't have to give it back or something, like a loan or something?
No, no.
So
yeah,
you don't have to give it back.
You take it from non-Muslim, and of course you use that money for halal purpose.
Mm-hmm. It's something like that kind of law, I remember, when it comes to the necessity, when push comes to shove, basically when you are starving and hungry, even the pork's meat becomes halal, right?
Yeah.
Only to actually quench your thirst and hunger.
You could give that example.
Yes.
In the case of necessity, extreme necessity, or
yeah,
when one is facing unbearable hardship,
yes,
you're allowed to do something,
okay,
to the extent that the necessity is removed.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Chavi. I hope you listen. You enjoyed listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.